signature was the red seal of the Draenei dragon. Rek refolded the scroll and returned it to his saddlebag. Surrender? A helping hand at the brink of the abyss? Virai returned from the stream, her hair dripping and her features flushed.
Ye gods, that was good, she said, sitting beside him.
Why the long face? Serbatar not awake yet? No. Tell me, what would your father have done if Abelain had told him to surrender the dross?
He would never have given that order to my father.
But if he had, insisted Rek, the point does not arise. Why do you always ask questions that have no relevance? He put a hand on her shoulder.
Listen to me. What would he have done?
He would have refused. Abelain would know that my father is the Lord of Drosdelnok, the High Warden of the North. He can be relieved of command, but not ordered to give up the fortress.
Suppose Abelain had then left the choice to Delnar.
What then?
He would have fought to the last. It was his way. Now, will you tell me what all this is about?
The dispatch Degas gave me for your father. It is a letter from Abelain withdrawing his fight to the last order.
How dare you open that? Stormed Virai. It was addressed to my father and should have been given to me. How dare you?
Her face red with fury, she suddenly struck out at him. When he parried the blow, she launched another, and without thinking he struck her, flat-handed, sprawling her to the grass. She lay there, eyes blazing.
I'll tell you how I dare, he said, suppressing his anger with great effort, because I am the Earl, and if Delnar is dead, then it was addressed to me, which means that the decision to fight is mine, as is the decision to open the gates to the Nadir.
That's what you want, isn't it? A way out. She rose to her feet, snatching up her leather jerkin.
Think what you like, he said. It doesn't matter to me. Anyway, I should have known better than to talk to you about the letter. I'd forgotten how much this war means to you. You can't wait to see the crow's feast, can you? Can't wait for the bodies to start swelling and rotting. You hear me?
He shouted at her back as she walked away.
Trouble, my friend?
Asked Vintar as he sat down opposite the angry wreck.
Nothing whatsoever to do with you, snapped the new Earl.
Of that I don't doubt, said Vintar calmly. But I might be able to help. After all, I've known Virai for many years.
I'm sorry, Vintar. That was unforgivable of me.
I have found in my life, Rek, that there are a few actions which are unforgivable, and certainly there are no words said that carry such a penalty. It is a man's lot, I fear, to strike out when he has suffered hurt. Now, can I help?
Rek told him about the dispatch and Virai's reaction.
A thorny problem, my boy. What will you do?
I have not yet made up my mind.
That is as well. No one should make a hasty decision over such a weighty matter. Do not be too hard on Virai. She is now sitting by the stream and feeling very miserable. She is desperately sorry for what she said, and is merely waiting for you to apologize, so that she can tell you it was all her own fault.
I'll be damned if I will apologize, said Rek.
It will be a frosty ride if you do not, said the abbot.
A soft moan came from the sleeping servitor. Instantly Vintar, Menahem, Arbedak, and Rek moved over to him. The albino's eyes fluttered and opened. Once more they were the green of rose leaves. He smiled at Vintar.
Thank you, Lord Abbot, he whispered.
Vintar patted his face gently.
Are you all right?
Asked Rek.
Serbatar smiled. I am well. Weak, but well.
What happened? Asked Rek.
Nostar Khan. I tried to force entry at the fortress and was flung into the outer mists. I was lost. Broken. I saw futures that were terrible and chaos beyond all imagining. I fled.
He lowered his eyes.
I fled in panic. I know not where or when. "Speak no more, Surbiter," said Vintar. "Rest now."
"I cannot rest," said the albino, struggling to rise. "Help me, Rek."
"Maybe you should rest, as Vintar says," Rek told him.
"No, listen to me. I did enter Delnok, and I saw death there. Terrible death."
"The Nadir are there already?" asked Rek.
"No, be silent. I could not see the man clearly, but I saw the Musiv well being poisoned behind wall two. Anyone who drinks from that well will die."
"But we should arrive before the fall of wall one," said Rek, "and surely they will not need the Musiv well until then."
"That is not the point. Eldebar, or wall one as you call it, is indefensible. It is too wide. Any capable commander will give it up. Don't you understand? That's why the traitor poisoned the other well. Drus is bound to fight his first battle there, and the men will be fed that day at dawn. By midday, the deaths will begin, and by dusk, you will have an army of ghosts."
"We must ride," said Rek. "Now, get him on a horse." Rek ran to find Virai as the 30 saddled their mounts. Vintar and Arbedark helped Surbiter to his feet. "There was more, was there not?" said Vintar.
"Aye, but some tragedies are best left unspoken."
For 3 days they rode in the shadow of the Delnok range into deep glens and over wooded hills. They rode swiftly but with caution, Menahem scouting ahead and pulsing messages to Surbiter. Virai had said little since the argument and avoided Rek studiously. He in turn gave no ground and made no attempt to breach the silence, though it hurt him deeply. On the morning of the fourth day, as they breasted a small hill above thick woods, Surbiter held up a hand to halt the column.
"What's wrong?" asked Rek, drawing alongside.
"I have lost contact with Menahem."
"Trouble?"
"I don't know. He could have been thrown from his horse."
"Let's go and find out," said Rek, spurring the mare.
"No!"
called Surbiter, but the horse was already on the move downhill and gathering speed. Rek tugged at the reins to bring the animal's head up, then leaned back in the saddle as the beast slithered to the foot of the hill. Once more on firm ground, Rek glanced about him. Amongst the trees he could see Menahem's grey standing with head down, and beyond, the warrior himself lying face down on the grass. Rek cantered the mare towards him, but as he passed under the first tree, a whisper of movement alerted him, and he flung himself from his saddle as a man leapt from the branches. Rek landed on his side, rolled and regained his feet, dragging his sword free of its scabbard. His attacker was joined by two others. All wore the flowing white robes of the Setuli. Rek backed towards the fallen Menahem and lanced down. The warrior's head was bleeding at the temple. Slingshot, Rek realized, but had no chance to check if the priest was still alive. Other Setuli now crept from the undergrowth, their broad tulwars and long knives in hand. Slowly they advanced, grins splitting their dark, bearded features. Rek grinned back.
"This is a good day to die," he said. "Why don't you join me?"
He slid his right hand further up the hilt of his sword, making room for his left. This was no time for fancy swordplay. It would be hack and stand two-handed. Once again he felt a strange sense of departure that heralded the Bearsark rage. This time he welcomed it. With an ear-piercing scream he attacked them all, slashing through the throat of the first man as his mouth opened in astonishment. Then he was among them, his blade a whistling arc of bright light and crimson death. Momentarily stunned by his assault, they fell back, then leapt forward again, screaming their own war cries. More tribesmen burst from the undergrowth behind him as the thunder of hooves was heard. Rek was not aware of the arrival of the 30. He parried a blow and backhanded his blade across the face of his assailant, stepping over the corpse to engage yet another tribesman. Surbiter fought in vain to establish a defensive ring that could include Rek. His slender blade swept out, kissing and killing with surgical precision. Even Vintar, the oldest and least capable swordsman, found little difficulty in slaying the Setuli warriors. Savage as they were untutored in fencing skills, relying on ferocity, fearlessness, and weight of numbers to wear down a foe. And this tactic would work again, Vintar knew, for they were outnumbered perhaps 4-1, with no avenue of retreat open to them. The clash of steel on steel and the cries of the wounded echoed in the small clearing.
Virai cut across the upper arm, disemboweled one man, and ducked beneath a slashing tulwar as a new attacker stormed in. Tall Antaheim stepped forward to block a second slash. Arbadark moved through the battle like a dancer. A short sword in each hand, he choreographed death and destruction like a silver ghost of elder legends. Rek's anger grew. Was it all for this? Meeting Virai, coming to terms with his fears, taking the mantle of Earl? Or so that he could die on a tribesman's tulwar in an unnamed wood? He hammered his blade through the clumsy guard of the Setuli before him, then kicked the falling corpse into the path of a new attacker.
"Enough!"
he yelled suddenly, his voice ringing through the trees.
"Put up your swords, all of you!"
The 30 obeyed instantly, stepping back and forming a ring of steel about the fallen Menahem, leaving Rek standing alone. The Setuli slowly lowered their swords, glancing nervously one to another. All battles, as they knew, followed the same pattern. Fight and win, fight and die, or fight and run. There was no other way. But the Tall One's words were spoken with power, and his voice held them momentarily.
"Let your leader step forth,"
ordered Rek, plunging his sword blade into the ground at his feet and folding his arms, though the Setuli blade still ringed him. The men before him stepped aside as a tall, broad-shouldered man in robes of blue and white moved forward. He was as tall as Rek, though hawk-nosed and swarthy. A trident beard gave him a sardonic look, and the saber scar from brow to chin completed the impression.
"I am Regnak, Earl of Drosdelnok," said Rek.
"I am Setuli, Joachim Setuli, and I shall kill you," replied the man grimly.
"Matters like this should be settled by men such as you and I," said Rek. "Look about you. Everywhere are Setuli corpses. How many of my men are among them?"
"They will join them soon," said Joachim.
"Why do we not settle this like princes?" said Rek. "You and I alone."
The man's scarred eyebrow lifted.
"That would only equal the odds against you. You have no bargaining power. Wherefore should I grant you this?"
"Because it will save Setuli lives? Oh, I know they give their lives gladly, but for what? We carry no provisions, no gold. We have only horses, and the Delnok ranges are full of them. This is now a matter of pride, not of booty. Such matters are for you and I to decide."
"Like all Drenai, you talk a good fight," said the Setuli, turning away.
"Has fear turned your bowels to water?"
asked Rek softly. The man turned back, smiling.
"Ah, now you seek to anger me. Very well, we will fight. When you die, your men will lay down their swords?"
"Yes."
"And if I die, we allow you to pass?"
"Yes."
"So be it. I swear this on the soul of Mehmet, blessed be his name."
Joachim drew a slender scimitar, and the Setulis around Rek moved back to form a circle about the two men. Rek drew his blade from the earth, and the battle began. The Setuli was an accomplished swordsman, and Rek was forced back as soon as the fight started. Serbitar, Virai, and the others watched calmly as blade met blade time and again. Parry, riposte, thrust and parry, slash and check. Rek defended frantically at first, then slowly began to counter. The battle wore on, with both men sweating freely. It was obvious to all that they were evenly matched in skill and virtually identical in strength and reach. Rek's blade sliced the skin above Joachim's shoulder. The scimitar licked out to open a wound on the back of Rek's hand. Both men circled warily, breathing deeply. Joachim attacked. Rek parried, launching a riposte. Joachim jumped back and they circled again. Arbadark, the finest swordsman of the 30, was lost in wonder at their technique. Not that he could not match it, for he could. Rather, that his skill was honed by mental powers which the two combatants would never comprehend on a conscious level. Yet both were using the same skills subconsciously. It was as much a battle of minds as of blades. Yet even here the men were well matched. Serbitar pulsed a question to Arbadark. It is too close for me to judge. Who will win?
I know not, replied Arbedag. It is fascinating.
Both men were tiring fast. Rek had established a two-handed grip on his longsword, his right arm no longer able to bear the full weight of the blade. He launched an attack which Joachim parried desperately. Then his sword caught the scimitar an inch above the hilt, and the curved blade snapped.
Rek stepped forward, touching the point of his sword to Joachim's jugular.
The swarthy Setuli did not move, but merely gazed back defiantly, his brown eyes meeting Rek's gaze.
And what is your life worth, Joachim Setuli?
A broken sword, answered Joachim.
Rek held out his hand and received the useless hilt.
What is the meaning of this?
Asked the surprised Setuli leader.
It is simple, answered Rek. All of us here are as dead men. We ride for Trostelnok to face an army, the like of which has not been seen before in this world. We shall not survive the summer. You are a warrior, Joachim, and a worthy one. Your life is worth more than a broken blade. We proved nothing by this contest, save that we are men. Before me, I have nothing but enemies in war. Since we will meet no more in this life, I would like to believe that I have left at least a few friends behind me.
Will you take my hand? Rek sheathed his sword and held out his hand. The tall Setuli smiled.
There is a strangeness in this meeting, he said,
for as my blade broke, I wondered, in that moment when death faced me, what would I have done had your sword snapped?
Tell me, why do you ride to your death?
Because I must, said Rek simply.
So be it, then. You ask me for friendship, and I give it, though I have sworn mighty oaths that no Draenei would feel safe on Setuli land. I give you this friendship because you are a warrior and because you are to die.
Tell me, Joachim, as one friend to another, what would you have done if my blade had broken?
I would have killed you, said the Setuli.
Chapter 17. The first of the spring storms burst over the Delnok Mountains as Gilad relieved the watch sentry on Wall 1. Thunder rumbled angrily overhead, while crooked spears of jagged lightning tore the night sky, momentarily lighting the fortress. Fierce winds whistled along the walls, shrieking sibilantly. Gilad hunched himself under the overhang of the gate tower, tugging the small brazier of hot coals into the lee of the wall. His cape was wet through, and water dripped steadily from his drenched hair onto his shoulders to trickle inside his breastplate, soaking the leather of his mail shirt. But the wall reflected the heat from the brazier, and Gilad had spent worse nights on the Sentran plain, digging out buried sheep in the winter blizzards. He regularly raised himself to peer over the wall to the north, waiting for a flash of lightning to illuminate the plain. Nothing moved there. Further down the wall, an iron brazier exploded as lightning struck it, and showers of hot coals fell close to him. What a place to be wearing armor, he thought. He shuddered and hunched closer to the wall. Slowly the storm moved on, swept over the Sentran plain by the fierce wind from the north. For a while the rain remained, sheeting against the grey stone battlements and running down the tower walls, hissing and spitting as random drops vaporized on the coals. Gilad opened his small pack and removed a strip of dried meat. He tore off a chunk and began to chew. 3 more hours, then a warm bunk for 3 more. From the darkness behind the battlements came the sound of movement. Gilad spun round, scrabbling for his sword, phantom childhood fears flooding his mind. A large figure loomed into the light from the brazier.
"Stay calm, laddie, it's only me," said Druss, seating himself on the other side of the brazier. He held out his huge hands to the flames. "Fire now, is it?" His white beard was wet through, his black leather jerkin gleaming as if polished by the storm. The rain had petered to a fine drizzle, and the wind had ceased its eerie howling.
Druss hummed an old battle hymn for a few moments as the heat warmed him. Gilad, tense and expectant, waited for the sarcastic comments to follow.
"Cold, are we? Need a little fire to keep away the phantoms, do we? Why pick my watch, you old bastard?" he thought.
After a while the silence seemed oppressive, and Gilad could bear it no longer.
"A cold night to be out walking, sir,"
he said, cursing himself with a respectful tone.
"I've seen worse, and I like the cold. It's like pain. It tells you you're alive."
The firelight cast deep shadows on the old warrior's weather-beaten face, and for the first time Gilad saw the fatigue etched there. "The man is bone-tired," he thought. Beyond the legendary armour and the eyes of icy fire, he was just another old man, tough and strong as a bull maybe, but old, worn out by time, the enemy that never tired.
"You may not believe it," said Druss, "but this is the worst time for a soldier, the waiting before the battle. I've seen it all before. You ever been in a battle, lad?"
"No, never."
"It's never as bad as you fear it will be, once you realize that dying is nothing special."
"Why do you say that? It's special to me. I have a wife and a farm which I'd like to see again. I've a lot of living to do yet," said Gilad.
"Of course you have. But you could survive this battle and come down with the plague, or be killed by a lion, or develop a cancer. You could be robbed and killed, or fall from a horse. Ultimately, you will die anyway. Everyone dies. I'm not saying you should give up and just open your arms to welcome it. You must fight it all the way. An old soldier, a good friend of mine, told me early in my life that he who fears to lose will never win. And it's true. You know what a bearsark is, boy?"
"A strong warrior," said Gilad.
"Yes, he is. But he's more than that. He's a killing machine who cannot be stopped. Do you know why?"
"Because he's insane."
"Yes, there is that to him. But more, he doesn't defend, because when he's fighting he doesn't care. He just attacks, and lesser men, who do care, die."
"What do you mean by lesser men? A man doesn't have to be a killer to be great."
"That's not what I meant. But I suppose it could have been. If I tried to farm, as your neighbour, men would say that I was not as good as you. They would look down on me as a bad farmer. On these battlements, men will be judged by how long they stay alive. Lesser men, or lesser soldiers, if you will, either change or fall."
"Why did you come here, Druss?" asked Gilad, meaning to ask why the axeman had chosen to interrupt his watch. But the warrior misunderstood.
"I came to die,"
he said softly, warming his hands and staring into the coals.
"To find some spot on the battlements to make a stand, and then to die. I didn't expect to have to take over the damned defence. A pox on it! I'm a soldier, not a general."
As Druss talked on, Gilad realized the axeman was not talking to him, not to Cull Gilad, the former farmer. He was chatting to just another soldier, at just another fire, at just another fortress. In microcosm, this scene was Druss's life, the wait before the war.
"I always promised her that I would stop and tend the farm, but always someone, somewhere, had a battle to fight. I thought for years that I was representing something, liberty, freedom, I don't know. The truth was always much more simple. I loved to fight." She knew, but had the good grace never to point it out. "Can you imagine what it's like to be a legend? The damned legend? Can you, boy?"
"No, but it must make you feel proud," said Gilad, uncertain.
"It makes you tired. It saps your strength when it should raise it. Because you can't afford to be tired. You're Druss the legend, and you're invulnerable, invincible. You laugh at pain. You can march forever. With one blow you can topple mountains. Do I look as if I can topple mountains?
Yes, said Gilad.
Well, I damn well can't. I'm an old man with a weak knee and an arthritic back. My eyes are not so good as they were either. When I was young and strong, the bruises always healed quickly. I was tireless then. I could fight all damned day. As I grew older, I learned to fake it and snatch rest where I could. To use my experience in battle where before I had just powered my way through. In my 50s, I was careful, and anyway, by that time, the legend made men tremble. 3 times since, I have fought men who could have beaten me. But they beat themselves because they knew who I was and were afraid. Do you think I'm a good leader?
I don't know. I'm a farmer, not a soldier, said Gilad.
Don't hedge with me, boy. I asked for an opinion.
No, you're probably not. But you are a great warrior. I suppose in years gone by you would have been a war chief. I can't tell. You've done wonders with the training. There's a new spirit at the Dross.
There are always leaders in my day, said Dross, strong men with quick minds. I have tried to remember all their lessons. But it's hard, boy. Do you see? It's hard. I've never been afraid of enemies I can face with an axe or my hands, if needs be. But the enemies at this fortress are not the same. Morale, preparation, fire gullies, supplies, liaison, organization. It saps the soul.
We'll not fail you, Dross, said Gilad, his heart reaching out to the older man. We will stand firm beside you. You have given us that, though I hated you for most of the training.
Hate breeds strength, laddie. Of course you will hold your men. Did you hear about Dun Menda?
Yes, it was tragic. A good job that he was there to aid you, said Gilad.
He was there to kill me, boy. And he almost did.
What? Said Gilad, shocked.
You heard me, and I don't expect you to repeat it. He was in the pay of the Nadir, and he led the assassins.
But that means you stood alone against them all, said Gilad. 5 of them, and you survived?
Aye, but they were a motley crew and ill-trained. Do you know why I told you that? About Menda?
Because you wanted to talk?
No, I've never been much of a talker, and I have little need for sharing my fears. No, I wanted you to know that I trust you. I want you to take over Mendar's role. I'm promoting you to Dun.
I don't want it, said Gilad fiercely.
Do you think I want this responsibility? Why do you think I spent this time here? I am trying to make you understand that often, more often than not, we are forced into doing what we fear. You will take over as of tomorrow.
Why? Why me?
Because I have watched you, and I think you have a talent for leadership. You've impressed me in leading your 10. And you helped Orin in that race. That was pride. Also, I need you, and others like you.
I've no experience, said Gilad, knowing it sounded lame.
That will come. Think on this. Your friend, Bregan, is no soldier, and some of your men will die at the first attack. Having a good officer will save some of them.
All right, but I can't afford to dine in the officer's mess or run up an armorer's bill. You will have to supply me with the uniform.
Menda's gear should fit you, and you will put it to more noble use.
Thank you. You said earlier on that you came here to die. Does that mean you think we cannot win?
No, it doesn't. Forget what I said.
Damn you, Dross, don't patronize me. You just talked about trust. Well, I'm an officer now, and I asked you a straight question. I won't repeat the answer, so trust me.
Dross smiled, and his eyes met the fierce gaze of the young sentry.
Very well. We have no chance in the long term. Every day brings us closer to a Nadir victory. But we will make them pay dearly. And you can believe that, laddie, for that's Dross the legend talking.
"Never mind the legend," said Gillard, returning the other's smile. "That's the man who took on 5 assassins in a darkened alley."
"Don't build me up too high because of that, Gillard. All men have talents. Some build, some paint, some write, some fight. For me it's different. I have always had a way with death."
The girl moved along the battlements, ignoring the comments of the soldiers, her auburn hair glinting in the morning sun, her long legs slender and bronzed, the object of many of the friendly, though intimate, comments from the troops. She smiled once, when one of the men she passed murmured to her companion, "I think I'm in love." She blew him a kiss and winked.
Bowman smiled, gently shaking his head. He knew Kaiser was making a meal of her entrance, but with a body like hers, who would blame her? As tall as most men, willowy and graceful, her every movement combined to promise pleasure to any man watching. Physically, Bowman thought, she is the perfect woman, the ultimate female. He watched her string her longbow. Jorak looked at him questioningly, but he shook his head. The rest of the archers stood back. This was Kaiser's moment, and after an entrance like that, she deserved a little applause. Store dummies had been set up 100 paces from the wall. The heads were painted yellow, the torsos red. It was a standard distance for a fine archer, but shooting down from a battlement added several degrees to the difficulty. Kaiser reached over her shoulder to the doeskin quiver and drew a black feathered shaft. She checked it for line, then notched it to the string. "Head," she said. With one flowing movement, she drew back the string, and as it touched her cheek, she loosed the shaft. It flashed through the morning air and hammered into the neck of the nearest dummy. The watching men burst into rapturous applause, and Kaiser glanced at Bowman. He raised an eyebrow. 5 more arrows lanced into the straw target before Bowman raised a hand to signal the other archers forward. Then he called Kaiser to him and walked from the battlements.
"You took your time getting here, lady," he said, smiling. She linked her arm in his and blew him a kiss. As always, he felt arousal stirring. As always, he suppressed it. "Did you miss me?" Her voice was deep and throaty, a sound as full of sexual promise as her body was a vision. "I always miss you," he said. "You raise my spirits." "Only your spirits, only my spirits." "You lie. I can see it in your eyes," she said. "You see nothing that I do not want you to see, or anyone else. You are safe with me, Kaiser. Have I not told you? But allow me to say that for a woman who does not seek the company of men, you make a very spectacular entrance. Where are your trousers?" "It was hot. The tunic is decorous enough," she said, absently tugging at the hem. "I wonder if you really know what you want," he said. "I want to be left alone." "Then why do you seek my friendship?" "You know what I mean." "Yes, I do," he told her. "But I'm not sure that you do." "You are very serious today, O Lord of the Forest. I can't think why. We are all being paid. We have our pardons, and the quarters are a sight better than Skultik."
"Where have they placed you?" he asked.
"The young officer, Pina, insisted that I have a room in the main barracks. He wouldn't hear of me sharing with the rest of the men. It was quite touching, really. He even kissed my hand."
"He's all right," said Bowman. "Let's have a drink."
He led her into the Elderbar mess hall and on through the officers' section at the rear, ordering a bottle of white wine. Seated by the window, he drank in silence for a while, watching the men train. "Why did you agree to this?" she asked him suddenly. "And don't give me any of that rubbish about pardons. You don't give a damn about that, or about the money." "Still trying to read me?" "It can't be done," he said, sipping his wine. Then he turned and called out for bread and cheese. She waited until the serving soldier had left. "Come on, tell me."
"Sometimes, my dear, as you will no doubt find when you are a little older, there are no simple reasons for a man's actions. Impulse. An act spurred by the moment. Who knows why I agreed to come here? I certainly do not." You're lying again. You just won't say. Is it that old man, Druss? Why are you so interested? In fact, why are you here? Why not? It should be exciting and not terribly dangerous. We are leaving, aren't we, when the third wall goes? Of course, that was the agreement, he said. You don't trust me, do you? She said, smiling. I don't trust anybody. You know, sometimes you do act just like every other woman I've known. Is that a compliment, O master of the green wood? I think not. Then what does it mean? After all, I am a woman. How do you expect me to act? There you go again. Let's get back to trust. What made you ask? You won't say why you came, and then you lie about leaving. Do you think I'm a complete fool? You have no intention of quitting this doomed pile of rock. You will stay to the end. And where do you come by this remarkable intelligence? He asked. It's written all over your face. But don't worry, I won't let on to Jorak or any of the others. But don't count on me to stay. I have no intention of dying here. Kaisa, my little dove, you only prove how little you know me. Anyway, for what it's worth... Bowman ceased his explanation as the tall figure of Hogan entered the doorway, and the Garn threaded his way through the tables towards them. It was Kaisa's first sight of the Legion General, and she was impressed. He moved with grace, one hand resting on his sword hilt. His eyes were clear, his jaw strong, and his features fair, handsome almost. She disliked him instantly. Her view was strengthened when he pulled up a chair, reversed it, and sat facing Bowman, ignoring her totally. "Bowman, we must talk," he said. "Go ahead. First, let me introduce Kaisa. Kaisa, my dear, this is Garn Hogan of the Legion." He turned and nodded once in her direction. "Do you mind if we talk alone?" he asked Bowman. Kaisa's green eyes blazed with anger, but she kept silent and stood, desperate for a parting remark that would sting the man. "I will see you later," said Bowman as she opened her mouth. "Get yourself some food now." As she turned on her heel and left the room, Bowman watched her, delighting in the feline grace of her walk. "You've upset her," he said. "Me? I didn't even speak to her," said Hogan, removing his black and silver helm and placing it on the table. "Anyway, that's immaterial. I want you to speak to your men." "What about?" "They spend a lot of their time loafing around and jeering at the soldiers as they train. It's not good for morale." "Why shouldn't they? They are civilian volunteers. It will all stop when the fighting starts." "The point is, Bowman, that the fighting may start before the Nadir arrive. I have just stopped one of my men from gutting that black-bearded giant Jorak. Much more of this, and we will have murder on our hands." "I'll talk to them," said Bowman. "Calm yourself and have a drink. What did you think of my Lady Archer?" "I really didn't look too closely. She seemed pretty." "I think it must be true what they say about the cavalry," said Bowman. "You are all in love with your horses. Great gods, man, she's more than merely pretty." "Talk to your men now. I'll feel a lot better then. Tensions are rising pretty badly, and the Nadir are only 2 days away." "I said I would. No, have a drink and relax. You're getting as edgy as your men, and that can't be good for morale." Hogan grinned suddenly. "You're right. It's always like this before a fight. Druss is like a bear with a sore head."
"I hear you lost the open swords to the fat one," said Bowman, grinning.
"Tut-tut, old horse. This is no time to be currying favour with the hierarchy." "I didn't let him win. He's a fine swordsman." "Don't judge him too harshly, my friend. He may yet surprise you. He certainly surprised me. What did you mean when you said I upset the girl?" Bowman smiled, then laughed loudly. He shook his head and poured another glass of wine. "My dear Hogan, when a woman is beautiful, she comes to expect a certain, how shall I say, a certain reverence from men. You should have had the good grace to be thunderstruck by her beauty, stunned into silence, or better still, into a babbling fool. Then she would have merely ignored you and answered your devotion with arrogant disdain. Now you have slighted her, and she will hate you. Worse than this, she will do all in her power to win your heart." "I don't think that makes a great deal of sense.
Why should she try to win my heart if she hates me? So that she can be in a position to treat you with disdain. Do you know nothing about women?
I know enough, said Hogan. I also know that I don't have time for this foolishness. Should I apologize to her, do you think?
And let her know you know how slighted she was. My dear boy, your education has been sadly lacking.
Chapter 18. Druss welcomed the arrival of the Druss Purdol riders, not so much for their numbers, more for the fact that their arrival proved that the Druss had not been forgotten by the outside world. Yet still, Druss knew, the defenders would be badly stretched. The first battle on Eldebar, Wall 1, would either raise the men or destroy them. The Delnok fighting edge was sharp enough, but spirit was a different thing. You could fashion the finest steel into a sword blade of passing excellence, but occasionally the move from fire to water would cause it to crack, where blades of lesser metal survived. An army was like that, Druss knew. He had seen highly trained men panic and run, and farmers stand their ground armed with picks and hoes. Bowman and his archers practiced daily now on Karnia, Wall 3, which had the longest stretch of ground between the mountains. They were superb. The 600 archers could send 3,000 arrows arcing through the air every 10 heartbeats. The first charge would bring the nadir into range for nearly 2 minutes before the siege ladders could reach the walls. The attacking warriors would suffer terrible losses over open ground. It would be bloody carnage. But would it be enough? They were about to see the greatest army ever assembled, a horde that within 20 years had built an empire stretching across a dozen lands and 50 cities. Ulrich was on the verge of creating the largest empire in known history, a mighty achievement for a man not yet out of his 40s. Druss walked the Eldebar battlements, chatting to individual soldiers, joking with them, laughing with them. Their hatred of him had vanished like dawn mist during these last days. They saw him now for what he was, an iron old man, a warrior from the past, a living echo of ancient glories. They remembered then that he had chosen to stand with them, and they knew why. This was the only place in all the world for the last of the old heroes. Druss the legend, standing with the last hopes of the Drenai on the battlements of the greatest fortress ever built, waiting for the largest army in the world. Where else would he be? Slowly the crowds gathered about him as more men made their way to Eldebar. Before long, Druss was threading his way through massed ranks on the battlements, while even more soldiers gathered on the open ground behind them. He climbed to the crenellated battlement wall and turned to face them. His voice boomed out, silencing the chatter.
"Look about you!"
he called, the sun glinting from the silver shoulder guards on his black leather jerkin, his white beard glistening.
"Look about you now! The men you see are your comrades, your brothers. They will live with you and die for you. They will protect you and bleed for you. Never in your lives will you know such comradeship again. And if you live to be as old as I am, you will always remember this day and the days to follow. You will remember them with a clearness you would never have believed. Each day will be like crystal shining in your minds. Yes, there will be blood and havoc, torture and pain, and you will remember that too. But above all will be the sweet taste of life. And there is nothing like it, my lads. You can believe this old man when he says it. You may think life is sweet now, but when death is a heartbeat away, then life becomes unbearably desirable. And when you survive, everything you do will be enhanced and filled with greater joy. The sunlight, the breeze, a good wine, a woman's lips, a child's laughter. Life is nothing unless death has been faced down. In times to come, men will say, 'I wish I had been there with them.' By then the cause won't matter. You are standing at a frozen moment in history. The world will be changed when this battle is over. Either the Draenei will rise again, or a new empire will dawn. You are now men of history."
Druss was sweating now, and strangely tired, but he knew he had to go on. He was desperate to remember Seban's saga of the elder days and the stirring words of an elder general, but he could not. He breathed in deeply, tasting the sweet mountain air.
"Some of you are probably thinking that you may panic and run. You won't. Others are worried about dying. Some of you will, but all men die. No one ever gets out of this life alive. I fought at Skeln Pass when everyone said we were finished. They said the odds were too great, but I said be damned to them. For I am Druss, and I have never been beaten, not by Nadir, Satuli, Ventrian, Vagrian, or Draenei. By all the gods and demons of this world, I will tell you now, I do not intend to be beaten here either."
Druss was bellowing at the top of his voice as he dragged Snaga into the air. The axe blade caught the sun, and the chant began.
"Druss, the legend! Druss, the legend!"
The men on other battlements could not hear Druss's words, but they heard the chant and took it up. Druss Delnok echoed to the sound, a vast cacophony of noise that crashed and reverberated through the peaks, scattering flocks of birds which took to the skies in fluttering panic. At last, Druss raised his arms for silence, and gradually the chant subsided, though more men were running from Wall 2 to hear his words. By now, almost 5,000 men were gathered about him.
"We are the knights of Druss Delnok, the siege city. We will build a new legend here to dwarf Skeln Pass, and we will bring death to the Nadir in their thousands, aye, in their hundreds of thousands. Who are we?" "Knights of Druss Delnok,"
thundered the men.
"And what do we bring? Death to the Nadir!"
Druss was about to continue when he saw men's heads turn to face down into the valley. Columns of dust in the distance created clouds which rose to challenge the sky like a gathering storm, like the father of all storms. And then, through the dust, could be seen the glinting spears of the Nadir, filling the valley from all sides, sweeping forward, a vast, dark blanket of fighting men, with more following. Wave after wave of them came into sight. Vast siege towers pulled by hundreds of horses, giant catapults, leather-covered battering rams, thousands of carts and hundreds of thousands of horses, vast herds of cattle, and more men than the mind could total. Not one heart among the watchers failed to miss a beat at the sight. Despair was tangible, and Druss cursed softly. He had nothing more to say, and he felt he had lost them. He turned to face the Nadir horsemen, bearing the horsehair banners of their tribes. By now their faces could be seen, grim and terrible. Druss raised Snaga into the air and stood, legs spread, a picture of defiance. Angry now, he stared at the Nadir outriders. As they saw him, they pulled up their horses and stared back. Suddenly the riders parted to allow a herald through. Galloping his step pony forward, he rode towards the gates, swerving as he came beneath the wall where Druss stood. He dragged on the reins, and the horse skidded to a stop, rearing and snorting.
"I bring this command from the Lord Ulrich," he shouted. "Let the gates be open, and he will spare all within, save the white-bearded one who insulted him."
"Oh, it's you again, lard belly," said Druss. "Did you give him my message as I said it?"
"I gave it, Deathwalker, as you said it."
"And he laughed, did he not?"
"He laughed, and swore to have your head. And my Lord Ulrich is a man who always fulfills his desires."
"Then we are two of a kind, and it is my desire that he should dance a jig on the end of a chain like a performing bear, and I will have it so. even if I have to walk into your camp and chain him myself.
Your words are like ice on the fire, old man, noisy and without worth, said the herald. We know your strength. You have maybe 11,000 men, mostly farmers. We know all there is to know. Look at the Nadir army. How can you hold? What is the point? Surrender yourself. Throw yourself on the mercy of my lord.
Laddie, I have seen the size of your army, and it does not impress me. I have a mind to send half my men back to their farms. What are you, a bunch of pot-bellied, bow-legged northerners? I hear what you say, but don't tell me what you can do. Show me. And that's enough of talk. From now on, this will talk for me.
He shook Snaga before him, sunlight flashing from the blade. Along the line of defenders, Gilad nudged Bregan.
Drush the legend, he chanted,
and Bregan joined him with a dozen others. Once more the sound began to swell as the herald wheeled his mount and raced away. The noise thundered after him.
Drush the legend! Drush the legend!
Drus watched silently as the massive siege engines inched towards the wall, vast wooden towers 60 feet high and 20 feet wide, ballistae by the hundred, ungainly catapults on huge wooden wheels. Countless numbers of men heaved and strained at thousands of ropes, dragging into place the machines that had conquered Gulgathir. The old warrior studied the scene below, seeking out the legendary war master, Kitan. It did not take long to find him. He was the still center of the whirlpool of activity below, the calm amid the storm. Where he moved, work ceased as his instructions were given, then began again with renewed intensity. Kitan glanced up at the towering battlements. He could not see Deathwalker, but felt his presence and grinned. "You cannot stop my work with one axe," he whispered. Idly he scratched the scarred stump at the end of his arm. Strange how, after all these years, he could still feel his fingers. The gods had been kind that day, when the Gulgathir tax-gatherers sacked his village. He had been barely 12 years old, and they had slain his family. In an effort to protect his mother, he had run forward with his father's dagger. A slashing sword sent his hand flying through the air to land beside the body of his brother. The same sword had lanced into his chest. To this day he could not explain why he had not died along with the other villagers, nor indeed why Ulrich had spent so long trying to save him. Ulrich's raiders had surprised the killers and routed them, taking 2 prisoners. Then a warrior, checking the bodies, had found Kitan barely alive. They had taken him into the steppes, laying him in Ulrich's tent. There they had sealed the weeping stump with boiling tar and dressed the wound in his side with tree moss. For almost a month he remained semi-conscious, delirious with fever. He had one memory of that terrible time, a memory he would carry to the day he died. His eyes had opened to see above him a face strong and compelling. The eyes were violet, and he felt their power.
"You will not die, little one. Hear me."
The voice was gentle, but as he sank once more into the nightmares and delirium, he knew that the words were not a promise. They were a command, and Ulrich's commands were to be obeyed. Since that day, Kitan had spent every conscious moment serving the Nadir Lord. Useless in combat, he had learned to use his mind, creating the means by which his lord could build an empire. 20 years of warfare and plunder. 20 years of savage joy. With his small entourage of assistants, Kitan threaded his way through the milling warriors and entered the first of the 20 siege towers. They were his special pride. In concept, they had been startlingly simple. Create a wooden box, 3-sided and 12 feet high. Place the wooden steps inside against the walls leading to the roof. Now take a second box and place it atop the first. Secure it with iron pins. Add a third, and you have a tower. It was relatively easy to assemble and dismantle, and the component parts could be stacked on wagons and carried wherever the general needed them. But if the concept was simple, the practicalities had been plagued by complexities. Ceilings collapsed under the weight of armed men, walls gave way, wheels splintered, and worst of all, once over 30 feet high, the structure was unstable and prone to tip. Khitan recalled how, for more than a year, he had worked harder than his slaves, sleeping less than 3 hours a night. He had strengthened the ceilings, but this had merely made the entire structure more heavy and less stable. In despair, he had reported to Ulrich. The Nadir warlord had sent him to Ventria to study at the University of Tertullus. He felt that he had been disgraced, humiliated. Nevertheless, he obeyed. He would suffer anything to please Ulrich. But he had been wrong, and the year he had spent studying under Ribo, the Ventrian lecturer, proved to be the most glorious time of his life. He learned of mass centers, parallel vectors, and the need for equilibrium between external and internal forces. His appetite for knowledge was voracious, and Ribo found himself warming to the ugly Nadir tribesmen. Before long, the slender Ventrian invited Khitan to share his home, where studies could be carried on long into the night. The Nadir was tireless. Often Ribo would fall asleep in his chair, only to wake several hours later and find the small, one-armed Khitan still studying the exercises he had set him. Ribo was delighted. Rarely had a student showed such aptitude, and never had he found a man with such a capacity for work. Every force, learnt Khitan, has an equal and opposite reaction, so that, for example, a jib exerting a push at its top end must also exert an equal and opposite push at the foot of its supporting post. This was his introduction to the world of creating stability through understanding the nature of stress. For him, the University of Tertullus was a kind of paradise. On the day he had left for home, the little tribesman wept as he embraced the stricken Ventrian. Ribo had begged him to reconsider, to take a post at the university, but Khitan had not the heart to tell him. He was not in the least tempted. He owed his life to one man, and dreamed of nothing but serving him. At home once more he set to work. Under construction the towers would be tiered, creating an artificial base 5 times the size of the structure. While being moved into position, only the first 2 levels would be manned, creating a mass weight low to the ground. Once positioned by a wall, ropes would be hurled from the center of the tower and iron pins hammered into the ground, creating stability. The wheels would be iron-spoked and rimmed, and there would be 8 to a tower to distribute the weight. Using his new knowledge, he designed catapults and ballistae. Ulrich was well pleased and Khitan ecstatic. Now, bringing his mind back to the present, Khitan climbed to the top of the tower, ordering the men to lower the hinged platform at the front. He gazed at the walls 300 paces distant and saw the black-garbed Deathwalker leaning on the battlements. The walls were higher than at Golgothia, and Khitan had added a section to each tower. Ordering the platform to be raised once more, he tested the tension in the support ropes and climbed down through the 5 levels, stopping here and there to check struts or ties. Tonight his 400 slaves would go to work beneath the walls, chipping away at the rocky floor of the pass and placing the giant pulleys every 40 paces. The pulleys, 6 feet high and cast around greased bearings, had taken months to design and years to construct to his satisfaction, finally being completed at the ironworks of Lentria's capital, 1,000 miles to the south. They had cost a fortune, and even Ulrich had blanched when the final figure was estimated. But they had proved their worth over the years. Thousands of men would pull a tower to within 60 feet of a wall. Thereafter the line would shrink as the gap closed. The 3-inch diameter ropes could be curled around the pulleys, passed under the towers, and hauled from behind. The slaves who dug and toiled to create the pulley beds were protected from archers by movable screens of stretched oxhide. But many were slain by rocks hurled from the walls above.
This was of no concern to Kitan. What did concern him was possible damage to the pulleys, and these were not protected by iron casing. With one last lingering look at the walls, he made his way back to his quarters in order to brief the engineers. Dras watched him until he entered the city of tents, which now filled the valley for over 2 miles. So many tents, so many warriors. Dras ordered the defenders to stand down and relax while they could, seeing in their faces the pinched edge of fear, the wide eyes of barely controlled panic. The sheer scale of the enemy had cut into morale. He cursed softly, stripped off his black leather jerkin, stepped back from the battlements, and lowered his huge frame to the welcoming grass beyond. Within moments he was asleep. Men nudged one another and pointed. Those closest to him chuckled as the snoring began. They were not to know that it was his first sleep for 2 days, nor that he lay there for fear that his legs would not carry him back to his quarters. They knew only he was Dras, the captain of the axe, and that he held the Nadir in contempt. Bowman, Hogan, Orin, and Kaiser also left the walls for the shade of the mess hall, the green-clad archer pointing at the sleeping giant. "Was there ever such a one?" he said. "He just looks old and tired to me," said Kaiser. "I can't see why you regard him with such reverence." "Oh, yes, you can," said Bowman. "You are just being provocative, as usual, my dear. But then that's the nature of your gender." "Not so," said Kaiser, smiling. "What is he, after all? He is a warrior, nothing more, nothing less. What has he ever done to make him such a hero? Waved his axe, killed men. I have killed men. It is no great thing. No one has written a saga about me." "They will, my lovely, they will," said Bowman. "Just give them time." "Dras is more than just a warrior," said Hogan softly. "I think he always has been. He is a standard, an example, if you like."
"Of how to kill people?" offered Kaiser.
"No, that's not what I meant. Dras is every man who has refused to quit, to surrender when life offered no hope, to stand aside when the alternative was to die. He is a man who has shown other men there is no such thing as guaranteed defeat. He lifts a spirit merely by being Dras and being seen to be Dras."
"Just words," said Kaiser. "You men are all the same. Always lofty words. Would you sing the praises of a farmer who fought for years against failed crops and floods?"
"No," admitted Hogan. "But then it is the life of a man like Dras which inspires farmers to battle on."
"Garbage," sneered Kaiser. "Arrogant garbage. The farmer cares nothing for warriors or war."
"You will never win, Hogan," said Bowman, holding open the mess hall door. "Give up now while you can." "There is a fundamental error in your thinking, Kaiser," said Orin suddenly, as the group seated themselves around a trestle table. "You are ignoring the simple fact that the vast majority of our troops here are farmers. They have signed on for the duration of this war." He smiled gently and waved his hand for the mess servant.
"Then the more fool them," said Kaiser. "We are all fools," agreed Orin. "War is a ridiculous folly, and you are right. Men love to prove themselves in combat."
"I don't know why, for I have never desired it myself, but I have seen it too often in others. But even for me, Dras is, as Hogan describes him, an example."
"Why?" she asked.
"I cannot put it into words, I'm afraid."
"Of course you can."
Orion smiled and shook his head. He filled their goblets with white wine, then broke the bread and passed it round. For a while they ate in silence. Then Orion spoke again.
"There is a green leaf called Neptis. When chewed it will relieve toothache or head pain. No one knows why, it just does. I suppose Dras is like that. When he is around, fear seems to fade. That's the best I can do to explain."
"He doesn't have that effect on me," said Kaiser. On the tower battlements, Bregan and Gilad watched the Nadir preparations. Along the wall, Dun Pinar supervised the setting of notched poles to repel siege ladders,
while Barbritan oversaw the plugging of scores of pottery jugs containing oil. Once filled and plugged, the jugs were placed in wicker baskets at various points along the walls. The mood was grim. Few words were exchanged as men checked their weapons, sharpened already sharp swords, oiled armor, or checked each shaft in their quivers. Hogan and Bowman left the mess hall together, leaving Orin and Kaiser deep in conversation. They sat on the grass, some 20 paces from the axeman, Bowman lying on his side and resting on his elbow.
"I once read some fragments from the Book of Elders," said the archer. "One line in particular strikes me now. Come the moment, come the man. Never did a moment call for a man more desperately than this. And Druss has arrived. Providence, do you think?"
"Great gods, Bowman, you're not turning superstitious, are you?" asked Hogan, grinning.
"I should say not. I merely wonder whether there is such a thing as fate, that such a man should be supplied at such a time."
Hogan plucked a stem of couch grass and placed it between his teeth.
"All right, let us examine the argument. Can we hold for 3 months until Woundweaver gathers and trains his army?